Experience of a 14-year-old boy who commenced work on the construction of the Haweswater Dam in July 1937. My name is Arthur Cannon, and I was born on the 2nd of June 1923 at Brough, Westmorland, the youngest of a family of five, one brother and three sisters. I was orphaned, having just reached the age of nine, and went to live with my Uncle Abraham on Stainmore, who, also like my father, was a well-known farmer. I came to the village of Burnbanks in 1937, having first left Brough School at the age of 14, to live with my brother Colin and two sisters at the Manchester Corporation Waterworks Club. Colin, at the age of 24, and previously landlord at the Greyhound Hotel Shap, had been appointed manager of the club in 1934, when the scheme to build the dam reopened. Initial work on this construction was commenced in 1930, but ceased in 1931, due to the Depression. My two sisters were also employed as assistants in the running of the club. The premises, a very large wooden built ground floor building, consisted of three bedrooms, living room, kitchen and bathroom. The club, one large bar, a large room with a long bar, at the front of which was, at ground level, sawdust and spittoons, which the navvies used. There was also a best room for senior staff. The beer cellar was a ground floor with the beer barrels on stillages kept cool with water sprinklers spraying on them. Beer arrived on a regular basis to Shap Station, mainly Tetleys of Leeds, and was delivered by Jack McCormick, Bampton Grange, on the back of his lorry. The club members, I estimate, some 200 to 250, mainly navvies, were hard drinkers and could easily down 12 to 14 pints on a good night. The premises opened at 5 p.m. when the hooter sounded at work, and there would be a mad dash to get in to be first served. Some of the members, navvies, would stay all night until closing time and not go to their lodgings for their evening meal. So much so, Colin had instructions to close the bar at 5:30 p.m. for half an hour, but it made little difference. They just sat on the wall outside until it reopened. This, for me, was a big change, having lived on Stainmore, where my uncle and his daughter and son were staunch Methodists. To live among the environment of the navvies was a real shock to me, but I feel has been a blessing in disguise, because the experiences I have gained have meant a lot to me in later life. I commenced work in short trousers, but later had long bib and brace overalls in July 1937 in the electrician's shop. Fred Bourne was the foreman electrician, and if I remember correctly, two other electricians and one mate. Frank Milliken was one of the electricians, and Harry Toome was the mate. We carried out all the electrical work in the course of construction of the dam, and I also remember assisting to lay the 3.5 kV cable, which runs from the dam and terminates in the substation located in the garage at the foot of the hotel. The cable runs behind the wall on the main road to the hotel. Power lines and telephone lines were run around the village, which covered some 60 buildings for the navvies and workpeople, and probably a dozen or so staff bungalows for senior people. The village policeman, P.C. Ossel, and his Alsatian lived in one of these. Mr. Harrison, followed by Mr. Prescott, Chief Cashiers, and Albert Ord were the others I remember who lived in them. In the village substation, I carried out the work of charging batteries for the radio sets. DC power was supplied by two Rushton Hornsby generating sets, with a further one, I believe, on standby, and there was also an AC rotary converter coupled to them. Hours of work were 49 and a half hour week, 7:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday to Friday, with half hour lunch break. Saturdays, 7:30 to 12 noon. Every 6 months on a Saturday, you were sacked to avoid paying superannuation, as the work was only classed as temporary. You clocked on and off each day, eyed closely by one-eyed Hawkeye, nickname Johnson, to ensure you clocked no one else in. Albert Ord was in charge of the diesel generating plant, and the Jewels were members of his staff. Sid Weir was in charge of building maintenance. Bill Pugh, the joiner's shop. Tommy Wilson was a joiner. Bill Sandham was painter, decorator and signwriter. Harry Dodd, chief sawyer. Harry Eastham and his son Bobby were office staff. Jack Fountain and his sons were employed on the cableway which ran above the dam to carry the strips of concrete required on the construction. Bill Kirby was a flagman employed on this work. Dr. Prentice of Shap was the village doctor. Tom Bell of Helton, the milkman. Totty Lowis, Penrith, the tailor, who got quite a lot of work off the navvies. There was a village store and separate news agents. Madge Robinson looked after the latter, assisted later by Tim Scott. Coulsons of Penrith provided the transport. Last bus was 10:30 p.m. Saturday, which my sister and self often missed because we were enjoying ourselves dancing at St. Andrew's Parish Hall until 5 minutes to 12 midnight, and then had to walk the long 10 to 11 miles back to Burnbanks. Happy days. The work on the dam for the navvies was very demanding, working in all weathers, keenly watched by foremen whilst using their pick and shovel. Some started at 7:30 and were sacked by 12 noon. Mr. Jamieson was the resident engineer and every afternoon did a tour of the site work, the offices being located on the hillside. I remember when in 1941 I volunteered for the RAF, and after spending 3 days at RAF Padgate, being called back to work by him and being severely reprimanded as I was in a reserved occupation. The only person then left on site with any electrical knowledge. Shortly afterwards, I repaired on my own the main LV underground cable that ran from the dam to the village substation after it had been damaged by workmen during excavation. I eventually was called into the forces 5th of November 1942. With a name like Cannon, it was obvious they needed more firepower. After war service, I resumed work as an electrician with the Manchester Corporation in Manchester, April 1947. That's all I had to say, you see. I didn't know, you know. Now, I could go on and say about the characters, such as Marmalade Joe, Nottingham Tom, Major Paddy Burns.
Are these some of the navvies?
These are some of the navvies, right, and the stories they're told.
Yes,
yes. You see?
Yes.
So, you know, well, I could just say that normal, could I now?
You can just say what you want, yes. Just tell me the stories you know about.
Make a cup of tea.
Yes, if you like.
Because I don't know whether that's any good, first bit.
It's brilliant, but it's all the facts. That's a brilliant collection of names and facts and dates.
That's right.
Now you want to fill in the human side of it.
Yeah, so I didn't mention one thing that happened. At the substation, I've mentioned to you at Horswater, I was with this electrician, and we had to move this panel off one wall onto another. And in so doing, he'd removed the main earth on this panel, and we were nearly electrocuted. But that hasn't got to be mentioned. I haven't mentioned it. It isn't on the
tape. It is still recording, yeah.
Is it? I'm
don't
sorry.
Don't worry, no, we can. Like I say, we'll type it all up.
Yeah.
You don't want to be in.
Yeah, so it's still recording.
Yes, so if you care to say anything else.
Now, the people that I can remember, such as I've just mentioned.
You said them.
Marmalade Joe, Nottingham Tom, Major Paddy Burns. These were hard drinking personnel, and one evening Marmalade Joe asked for a bottle of Guinness, and the men had asked me to fill him a bottle with water. He almost cleared the bottle before he realised that it was water, and he then flung the bottle at the mirror behind the bar. My brother Colin was most annoyed and said, "Arthur, you must never do that again."
Had some of these people been on the road for a while, you know, going from job to job?
You see, these people came, and they came really, mainly, I thought, from the West Cumberland. Work was very difficult to get over there.
And
they usually came with a stick over the shoulder with a red handkerchief, and that was all the belongings in there. And they came, there was about 15 or 16 of them located in these huts, and the man and his wife, they looked after the man working on the scheme, and they looked after the men. But they were just in a very small, just a corridor, like it was just a small room.
Yes. How long did they stay? Did they usually stay?
Well, the majority of them stayed, you know, once they got accustomed to the work. They were quite good work people. There was only one or two, you might say, were called dossers, and they were soon found out.
These are the ones you said would start in the morning, be sacked
by lunchtime. Yes. And
What about the people with families? There were men with families, weren't there?
There were the
houses.
There were the they were I don't know how to describe them, really. They were just ordinary living people, but there was quite a lot. You see, there was like the Crabtree family. There was the Sullivans and the Cooks. And they were a close-knit community. Rather strange, if there was any trouble in the club, it usually occurred at a break time, at Christmas or an Easter, and it usually involved the family. But my brother was pretty athletic those days, and he was soon over the bar, and he had a very nice way with him, and he used to say, look, you know, I think the best you can do is go home, and, you know, you'll be better. You've had probably too much to... There's one thing about Colin, he certainly knew how to handle men. He was a very well-respected person, and he was also very interested in cattle, and used to regularly attend the auction marts in Penrith, and he used to buy cattle, and he would have them rented out with various of his farmer friends, and then at the back end of the year he used to have a sale. But he was very knowledgeable. He could sell a cow or a calf, and years after he could recognise it in the fields. And the stories I used to hear from him, you know, with other farmers when they came to see him, and probably they were thinking of sending the cattle to the auction mart, and he would say, well, you know, don't you think, Tommy, you know, if I gave you so much now, it would be better that way for it. He said, you know, you've got the expense of getting it then, and if it isn't sold, you know, you've got to bring it back home again, I'll tell you what. And, you know, these discussions used to go on well past midnight, I mean. And my sister, Binny, used to say, well, I'm going to bed, I've, you know, and he just liked, he liked the country life, he liked farming, whereas myself, with having lost my parents at such a young age, and being with my uncle on Stainmore, it was rather a strict upbringing. And, man, it did me no harm, there's no doubt about that. But I really wanted to get away from there, and I didn't really take the same interest in farming as I should have done. But, you know, I was made to work very hard, and if I went off, say, to any football matches and hadn't told them, they were worried where I was. I used to be sent home to bed. I didn't used to have any food. But really, it at the end of the day, it didn't do me any harm. But then, from having experienced that life and going, you know, I thought as a young lad... You know, it was good to be among these people, these navvies.
They must have had some interesting tales to tell. And...
Yeah, there were, really. You know, time has gone on now that... I cannot really remember.
Yes. So what... Presumably, when you started at 14, they would have given you training on the job, would they? Or had you done anything before?
Electrical? Oh, no, nothing at all,
so
nothing.
I'd
come straight off the farm.
Yeah, so you learnt on the job.
So I went in there and, I mean, the first, it was the wooden, the electrician's shop. Again, it was of wooden construction with a stove, an iron stove, and my first job was... to, you know, light the stove
make
and
the tea.
Make the tea, and and you got all the usual, you know.
Sorry, that would be me.
Okay, carry on.
You had the usual tricks played on you as a young boy, you know. You were probably such as Frank Millican, the electrician, probably working for him in the dam. And he'd say, look, you know, we're probably trying to reach up to something we couldn't get to. And he would say, oh, just pop along to the electrician's shop and see, you know, see Tommy Wilson. See if you can get the long stand off him. You know, and so you went for the long stand, and that's all he got. It was a long sand.
Wait over there.
Wait over there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you got used to that in the end.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, did you have someone to work with? Were you sort of like an electrician's mate?
And
you
well, I was like the apprentice, yeah.
Did you work with lots of different people?
I did. As I say, there was about four of us staff.
And you were
sent, yeah. And then you were sent with them, and you watched what they did, and as I say, I must have had a good knowledge of what they did, because you were able to repair cables on your own at a very young age,
which was quite a responsibility.
Quite a responsibility.
Yeah.
Repairing, I feel I couldn't do it today. But it was only by having seen what was done and that you were able to do this work.
Yes. Yeah.
For instance, while I was there, I think he was the man who opened the dam, so Alderman William Walker. Mm. He came to reside in one of the staff bungalows of the village. And I remember being sent down there and rewiring that bungalow for him. He wanted sockets and lights in different places, and he was Alderman Sir William Walker and Lord Sir Treen. They were two of the three members of the committee that for the whole of the country that investigated any electrical breakdowns. The Westman Supply Company were rather concerned because he was often onto them when there was any interruption of supply, and they were not aware of who he was until I explained.
Yes, so quite a responsibility wiring his house. Really.
Well, it was.
If anything had gone wrong, then.
Well, it would have been.
Would have looked bad for you.
Would have done.
What about the other electricians? Have they had the similar start?
Well, I think
that they'd learned on other jobs.
They would be properly trained. They would be.
Do you think they would?
They were senior to me. You know, they were in the 20s,
yeah.
And they would serve their apprenticeships with local electrical contractors such as, say, W.H. Smith of Penrith, and. There was another man that came. He did come to assist me from time to time. Tommy Watson, who was employed by a Carlisle firm, David Thompson's of Carlisle, he did come to assist me if there were some large jobs I could not compete. But I had been left at the age of 16 as the only person on the building of the dam, because the others had been called away to other places on war service, and some had been called out to West Cumberland. You know, there was only four to start with.
You to hand out
after. Yeah, right.
So you were the only one left?
I was the only one left.
And at that point, the project wasn't finished?
The project wasn't finished.
So how on earth did you...
You were just, as I say, the instructions were Mr. Waddicker was in Manchester. He was this head electrical and mechanical engineer. And having been on my own, I felt I'd have liked to have gone to Manchester, you know, to gain further experience. But when I spoke to him about it, he said he would see what he could do, and I did get the chance to go. The letter came, and I was friendly with Florence McCormick in the typist's office, and I came in that morning to tell her that I'd just got my papers to go into the army. She said, "Well, that's strange. There's a letter arrived from Manchester, which says you're going to start work in Manchester, and Mr. Ralph Attersley is coming to take over from you on November the 5th. And on that particular day, that was the day that I got my papers to join His Majesty's forces. That's it was rather amazing. So up till that time, as I say, I was entirely on my own.
That must have been a bit scary.
Well, I don't really think when you're young, you don't realise really, because you know the work. Really, it was only feeding out to supply machines and that, and the fact that you'd taken notice of what was, as I say, you always had at the back of your mind if there was something you couldn't. I think it was only on two occasions that I had to go to see Mr. Jamieson and say to him that I felt it was too much. And they would send out this Tommy Watson from Carlisle who would come and do the necessary work.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There
was the recreation hall and the village the mission hall. That's where they held the dances. There were a very good maple floor there for dancing. Billy Bowman used to come from West Cumberland. He was the main one. Dances were that good. I remember my sister having to cater for them for evening meals there. But the dances were that good. I've seen them being clapped, and the dances not finishing until 2:30 in the morning. And people still went to work the following morning at 7:30.
So people used to come from quite a way off.
They did. And there was only two cars in the village. Colin had one, and Dexter's had the other. And Colin, on a night time, he probably did about, anything 10 to 12 journeys to Askham and Lazenby with different carloads. I mean, he had a long wait after the dance finished. If you were one of the last to be picked up, he had a standard 12, and he used to get 12 in it. You know how we did it, I don't know, but there was only means of transport. Yep.
Did you play any of the other sports? Because there was also a bowling green there, and
I don't remember balls being played. I played played a lot of tennis.
Right.
Uh-huh. Tennis was played quite a lot. I didn't remember bowls being played. I may be wrong.
Bowling thought there was a bowling green. And quoits as well, when you throw the horseshoe.
Oh yes, that was a popular pastime, quoits. And a ring board, for throwing rings.
Yeah.
And of course darts was very popular in the club. I became quite a professional at darts because I played really all weekend, and I was playing at fictitious names. I was playing against Bill Farrell in my mind, and Johnson in my mind. We played with wooden darts with lead in the centre of the wooden dart, and they had goose feathers. They were all one. They weren't separate. The flight wasn't separate. The shaft and the flight were all made one with a lead barrel depending on the weight of the dart you required. And with throwing so many darts at a young age, I got very, very quick, so quick that as soon as the first dart had gone in, the last dart was fallen. I hadn't seen the second dart go in. And by that, I think I used to baffle a lot of people. We used to go into Penrith on a Saturday night, and there wasn't very many people that would beat me. And funny, used to play for money too. Those days, yeah, we used to play for money. So I remember one occasion, a man coming, and he was supposed to be an expert dart thrower from the northeast. He came doing some building work. And I hadn't been going. Oh, I'm sorry. This was later in life. A chap where I was told that this man was bragging about playing darts. So the locals asked me to go in and just play around as if you couldn't throw, because he was challenging people. That he'd play anybody when he got his pay on Friday for a fiver. So I duly went in on the Friday and cleaned up, and if the man, he was very annoyed, but I was very lucky that my brother Colin just happened to come into the King's Arms at the time, and it all passed off all okay. But it just shows that it doesn't do to brag too much about what you can do and what you can't do.
Yes, what were your sisters called?
Sisters were Binny.
Is that short for something? Or?
Albina.
Albina, I think, was it?
It's an unusual name.
Yes.
And Femi. Femi. Phemie. Femi. And Dorothy was the third sister. Dorothy was the only one of the family that went to grammar school. She went to Kirby Stephen Grammar School. She left home after being at grammar school. She must have left home before my father had died. Colin had left before my father. There was only my sister Femi, who was 4 years older than me, and myself left at Brough with my father when he died. Colin had gone as a boots boy to the Greyhound Hotel at Shap. He would go at the age of 14. And Binny went shortly afterwards to be a maid there. These were the days when hotels were hotels. Mm. Lord Lonsdale was the big man in the place then. He used to visit the place, and they used to have visitors. I went to the hotel on my holidays from Stainmore when I was 12 years of age, and I thought it was marvellous. Mm. Visitors were staying there, and you know, I got the odd shilling and that, and had a lovely time. And I got back home on Stainmore, and I thought, this is a better life than this. So I ran away the following morning. I got the workman's bus at 6:30 from Brough, and arrived back in Shap about 9 o'clock. And I was knocking on the front door of the hotel, and my sister Binny came, and she said, "It's our Arthur here." So I ran away and hid in under the railway bridge. Anyway, eventually they got me, and the end of the story was I was marched through Brough by my sister, never ever to do that again. So that was it. So that was why when I became 14, I was so keen to get away. My brother Colin was good to me, like Colin, when I was there. He made me such things as a snow sledge and bought a cycle for me, which helped me. I had 3 miles to go to walk back and forward to school, and I had to go to the Wesleyan and Methodist chapels twice a day, Sunday schools. I was born next door to at Highfield Farm at Brough. That was next door to the well-known Dr. Bainbridge, who went on horseback round the countryside. His daughter Joyce, she was featured in the Cumberland and Westmorland Herald, having kept the surgery for 40 years, just as he had left it when he died. Mm. Joyce and my sister Dorothy, they were very friendly. Going back to my sister Dorothy, she went to grammar school at Brough, at Kirby Stephen, and her first job was in London, in a secretarial position with Lord Dawson of Penn, who was the then King's physician. I remember this vividly because I was collecting foreign stamps at the time, and I used to get envelopes addressed to Lord Dawson, with the stamps on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As soon as I'd been called into the forces in 1942, Dorothy had then left, and she was working for the ICI at Millbank in London, but they'd been evacuated during the war years to Hawkshead in the Lake District. But as soon as she knew I'd been called into the forces, she volunteered for the RAF with a view to getting a commission, and which she did later, and she finished up as a squadron officer, did Dorothy. So that's why she was never with us when we were at Burnbanks. This is why Colin, I think, did a marvellous job to keep the rest of us, four of us, together,
yes,
having lost our parents at such an early age.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, he was a man I have every respect for, and so had many other people.
Mm-hmm. So, did your sisters stay on at Burnbanks?
My sister, because when it became, in 1941, when this construction of the dam was completed, my brother, all he got from the Manchester Corporation was a simple letter to say that on, I can't recall the date, but it was in 1941, it just said that as from this date, his services would no longer be required. There was no thank you for his service from 1934 to 1941. It just said that he'd have to vacate the premises. So Colin and Binny and Feemy went to Bampton Grange Farm. He was renting the farm. He could have bought that farm for £600, but he was renting it. So Binny had got married to Bill Johnson, who had worked on the scheme, and he was away in the Coldstream Guards. So when he got injured in Louvain when the Belgians capitulated, he came back to live at Bampton Grange. And then they shortly took a pub themselves. It was the Fishertel in Penrith, the Fishertel. They got the tenancy for that from Glasson's Brewery.
Mm.
And they finished up, they had two or three others. They had the General Wolf. And Feemy, I just cannot recall properly, Feemy was, I think she'd volunteered for the RAF. Feemy became a corporal cook in the RAF.
Mm-hmm.
So there was just Colin, Binny, Bill Johnson and myself at Bampton Grange. I used to go from there to work till I was called up in 1942.
Right. So did you cycle in? Or?
That's right.
Yeah.
And Colin, he then got married. He got married, and he took the tenancy of a farm at Shap. At Shap, that's right. Yeah. So that was it. Binny finished. My sister Binny finished in the licensing trade. She died when she was 60, at the General Wolf, and Feemy, my other sister, died 1995. She lived at Lytham St Anne's, Blackpool.
Mm-hmm.
She'd married an RAF sergeant whilst she was in the forces, who, and he'd worked for the after in civil life he'd worked for the premium bonds in London, but got transferred to the to their place in Blackpool. So we were a closely knit family, really. As I say, they're my sister and my two sisters are both dead. Colin died in 1986, and Dorothy, who was the second youngest sister, is she, Dorothy?
She was the middle sister.
Middle sister. She's now
91.
And unfortunately not in good health, and is going to be shortly in going to a nursing home, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we're just...
So what was Burn Banks like towards the end of that time? It must have been far fewer people around.
There was far fewer, yeah.
Compared to its heyday when it was bustling.
There was far fewer. There wasn't, you see, there wasn't much then, because as, with the work having ceased in 1941, there was only a few left, like really employed on forestry work, really, and there was odd people employed on the maintenance work. I know Mr. Long. He was the resident engineer, because when I came out of the forces in 1946, he said, I was thinking I was going to go back to Haweswater, and he told me they'd been asking about me in Manchester, but when I applied to go back, they said that there was no work there. It had only been a temporary, all other people had, they'd finished, and they'd no reason to take me back. There wasn't any work for me. So I went to the Labour Exchange in Penrith, saw Mr. Brown, who was the manager there, and he said that was wrong. They had to take me back. It was part, that they had to take me back. I think it was for a minimum of 2 years. So I wrote back and said, and eventually it finished up. I had to go to Key Street in Manchester to a tribunal to put my case. Mr. Waddicker was there. They asked me if I was legally represented. I said I wasn't. But I told them what had happened prior to going into the forces, that I'd been promised a job in Manchester. And I think with Mr. Waddicker being at the interview, they found in my favour, and I started back with them almost a year after. I'd come out of the forces. I'd been helping my brother on the Colin on the farm at Shap. He'd taken this farm over at Shap. Yes. And it was due to that I think enabled me to get, day release to study electrical engineering at Salford. I think that again was all due to Mr. Waddicker. The fact that he had remembered me when I was at Haweswater.
When you were actually working as an electrician at Burn Banks, were you out of doors quite a lot? Was it mainly inside?
Oh, no,
when
it was...
you were laying cables, it would have been out.
Oh, yeah, it was very... I mean, it wasn't easy. I mean, as the dam got up, I mean, the height of that dam... Well, the length of it is roughly a quarter of a mile. And the height was, it's roughly 100 foot at the height where the slipway is. I mean, I had some arduous tasks. I mean, I used to have to go up into the control room at the one side of the lane. I'd climb up the steps and carry out maintenance work on the machinery within the tower that drove the cableway across the dam. And then I used to, I had to do work up at the valve shaft that, that's beyond the hotel. I would say it's about a mile beyond the Hosewater hotel. That's where the water is taken through the fell side, taken through to the north side of Kendal, tunnelled through. I think that was tunnelled before the actual work commenced on the building of the dam in 1930. I think that was done in the 1920s, probably a 26th time. There could have been one or two people killed when that tunnel was built. And from there, there's a joining point with the Thirlmere one, and it's taken through. There's booster pumps on the way through.
So was it pumps that you were...
There was pumps in the bottom of the valve shaft. I worked in... Well, I did the electrical work in installing those. And then later, when I came out of the forces, when I went to Manchester, I got the job of doing work at Thirlmere. I did the whole of the electrical, the putting up the poles and doing all the work connected with the forestry, because they had been on the, their own private generating. You just had batteries at Thirlmere, but we got the, we then received the supply from the Mid Cumberland electricity supply, and it was quite good. I got the job of doing all this work. I used to employ, say, a labourer, you know. So you had, without being big-headed, you got a fairly good electrical knowledge.
And you had to do other things as well, presumably, like, you know, if you're dealing with putting up poles.
Yeah.
Who would dig the holes and all that kind of thing? And
well, yeah, well, this
cables,
is it.
Cables have to go in trenches.
That's right, cables. Yeah, yeah.
You had to do all the digging. And
yeah, that's right, yeah.
Is that you
I
as
mean,
well?
Yeah. You see, the thing was, I remember, you know, when you were young, when going back to Hosewater, I remember when the work had ceased on the dam, you see, as you quite rightly say, it became pretty dormant in the village then. So a lot of the overhead lines that had been put up, you know, some, well, they were put up really prior to me starting in 37, well, all that had to come down. And I remember, you know, but just working on your own, having the ladder up on the pole and sawing through the overhead cable, and then coming to the last cable that wanted to be cut, and then sawing through it, and then the pole going, the fact that it had lost the tension of the pole swinging one, been thrown off, and fortunately landing in a heap of bushes. I mean, if you don't realise how lucky you were, you could have been killed if it fell on the concrete road. And you hadn't realised what you were actually doing, that pole was being held up more in a vertical position due to the wire that you were cutting. Yeah. Because it was all like, well, you know, there was up three or four conductors up there, plus telephone wires as well. You know, he probably had about five different cables. Well, all that had to be dismantled. You see, and then the huts and that, they would be being dismantled. But, you see, there was always a few remained, really, you know. See, that was done, really. Well, it was, there was no need to keep it there after 41. See, and it was... It would probably be the summer, at least, at the latest, that the scheme was finished. See, I remember when it was done, like, and the water coming over the top. I mean, there was always compensation water that went in the base of the tunnel that goes out to the River Lowther, like down there. That, I mean, that lake, I would say, you know, when it set off, it would only be maybe about 2.5 miles in length, but it finished up after it was full, about 4 miles, I would think. It didn't half. Mm-hmm. It holds quite a volume of water.
Mm-hmm. When was it finally full, then?
Well, it was in 41.
That was when it
finally... That's when it came over the top, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's when it came over the top. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was a marvellous to see it being constructed, you know, as it went up, you know, shuttering work, you know, the shuttering was... Mm-hmm. And then,
the joiners.
That's right, yeah. And then, as I say, where the concrete mixing was, and then the skip overhead came down and picked the skip up full of concrete, and then they were taken up, and then there would be a flagman waving it through. Jack Fountain would be in the control tower. Well, this, you know, it's, you know, went to, you know, come forward and then let it down, and it wasn't just done in nice fine weather. It
was all weathers.
Torrential rain. And we were out there as well. We were, you know, having to, if something had gone wrong, I mean, cables that were always getting cut. And that's why I think you got a good knowledge of... Man, these were only temporary cables there. They weren't like the main, the main underground cables. Mm. Mm.
I remember that day when we went into the dam, that time we were shown round inside. You said you put all those wires along the side, you had to chip out all the...
Oh, cables. Yeah, you see, when the dam, when it was first electrified... I had the job. There was no power tools. Every bracket was made carrying at the start of the entrance of the tunnel, radiating out, probably starting with about 24 conduits. Well, there'd be a dozen conduits going east, a dozen conduits going west, along the chambers of inside the tunnel.
Inside the dam, right.
And they had to be these conduits, metal pipes, were supported on brackets, and you had to fasten those brackets to the concrete wall of the dam, mm. And you did that by hammer and chisel. There was no power, no simple thing like a power tool to drill a hole, to put a roll plug in, it had to be...
That must have taken a long
time. And the number of times the tool and hit your hand was... Yeah. And it wasn't very nice, really. Mm-hmm. There's one thing about it, really. It was good if it was winter time, because it was warm in there. But summertime it was absolutely freezing. Mm. In summer, but wintertime it was. You could feel the heat really as you walked in. Mm-hmm. See, you could walk, right through from one end to the other. Yeah. Mm. Now that was done with conduits and what they call VIR cables. But unfortunately, due to the condensation in the dam, this type of wiring, the conduits got full of water. Mm. So there was faults developing greatly. So the whole thing had to be redone. It was redone after my time there. It was redone with pyrotechnics cabling, which is a solid cable, not affected by dampness. Mm-hmm. But these before were like pipes,
yes,
with cables running through them.
Yes, yes.
So naturally, you know, there was junction boxes and so forth. Well, you couldn't stop condensation, mm-hmm, getting in them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And did you would have seen the conditions that the the navvies worked under us.
Oh, I mean, it was
spreading the concrete and.
Oh yeah, I mean, it was, you know, there was. Forget some of them. Might have been Sullivan. Some these they were very hard on them. The foreman blinking navvy. You know, he'd be stood there over the, watching them in the thing, and he'd have a dewdrop from his nose, you know. But he was more interested in what they were doing. Yeah, it was hard. Actually, when I look back, you know, I sometimes thought it. See, I got 8 and 6 months a week when I went into the electrician's shop. That was my pay. Well, you were better paid if you got a job as a nipper, what they'll call, I think it was a nipper, getting, say, a few workmen, few of the navvies. You got 6 months a man off the navvy if you brewed tea for him. So you only needed maybe half a dozen of those and you were better off in pay. And as a young lad, I used to think, well, I'd be better off than chipping, flipping holes in the concrete to put these cables on.
So the navvies used to have someone brew them tea.
That's right, yeah.
On the job.
They must have had, yeah.
So they didn't actually stop and go.
They didn't stop, and I think and I think they must have been employed. These boys must have been employed by the corporation to do that, or whether you just went onto the site and you were allowed to do that and collect this money, you know. But you certainly did get. You used to have your own, because there used to be fallout. So it's a bit between the boys, because you'd probably pinch one of his customers.
Yes.
Yeah, and also round there, while the dam was being constructed, there was this miniature railway line. Well, that was quite an attraction. You know, I think, well, you know, I say, oh, yeah, hello, Arthur. You know, they're riding round on the lot. You think, oh, I'd sooner have that job than the job I've got. Little realising that at the end of the day, there was nothing for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. See, I was fortunate. I think that my brother Colin was able to get me the job in there, you know. Yeah.
Was there any representation, any trade unions, or
not that I'm aware of.
Was it actually not allowed, or was it?
I don't think it was allowed.
Right.
No, I think if anybody had started up, you know, to form a union, they would have found some way of getting rid of the person. I mean, those days, you know, you were given a job to do, and if you didn't like the job, well, you know, get off, go on, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Work was very scarce, you see, and hard to come by.
Mm.
That's why, you know, the normal hours, as I say, were, you know, this 49 and a half hour week. But, you know, there was quite a lot of, you know, looking for overtime, extra work, you know, if they could get it, because money meant such a lot, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. High overtime was, you know, you more or less had to be a favourite of the gang that you were working in. I think probably, you know, one or two that got overtime, they gave these people a backhander, really, that had given them the overtime.
Yeah.
I think, honestly think, things like that went on, unofficially, of course. But and there was no question of, you see, if you were ill, say if a navvy was ill, as I say, you only had this little cubicle to live in, you know, there wasn't room for a chest of drawers, I don't know, just the bed, that's all he had. You know, and then there were such things as sickness. I remember there was a big fight one day with this flagman, and he was only a little man, Bill Kirby, and the other chap was quite a strong man. He was employed in the blacksmith's shop. He was from Carlisle, a big, tough man, and he was, you know, he another that could, what he could do and what he couldn't do, but this little man, Kirby, when the other man had had a few drinks, he challenged him to a fight. This was outside the club, and I've never seen anything like it before, never since or before. He just absolutely hammered this man's face and that it must have been 5 minutes. Well, that plumber man, he went back to his cubicle, and he wasn't seen for about a week or a fortnight, recovering from his injuries.
And presumably there'd be no pay, would there?
There would be no pay for him.
If you don't work because you're sick.
That's right. Oh, there was no such thing as...
No sick leave.
No sick leave. No, no, no.
So that
no,
was tough.
It was.
Yes.
Yeah.
People just carried on if they were ill, I suppose.
That's right. That's right.
Yes.
No, he didn't get sick pay. Funnily enough, although the conditions were hard, I don't remember really any serious accidents there. Small ones. I remember I nearly had my finger end chopped off with a rolling a drum of cable that I'd forgot when it was going round, and the flipping thing went, my fan was still on it, and the drum and the finger made contact with the concrete floor, and it squashed the finger end. That's only really clusters of mind, right? But there was odd pieces, I think, of eye, so, you know, or probably concrete or something, or you know. But I don't know of anyone really, any loss of limbs or anything like that. And you'd have thought there would have been, really.
Because
there wasn't any safety harness.
No,
You know, you're working on the, you know. And I mean, some of the men used to have to go along this cableway, you know, greasing the darn thing, you know, to suspend it. Well, it must have been, it's a fair height up.
Yes.
So I remember once, while I was there, you know, as I say, it was there in the war years, when they must have been carrying out practice dive bombing, the RAF. I remember once planes coming over and diving down. I don't think they realised that there was this cableway, you know, and there must have been for the dam busters doing practice runs.
Yeah.
I remember that. And I also remember when flares were dropped in the village overnight, when probably it was only a... And there was a bomb. I think they were trying to bomb the valve shaft at the far end of the lake.
Mm.
They must have seen the glass roof, you know, as it maybe shining in the sunlight, and he was offloading his bombs, and they were in direct line with the tower, but within about 100 yards on the fell side.
Mm.
Quite eerie that night when, you know, there were... The, you know, of course, it could be a good target, really, for...
Yes.
That was the only time we ever experienced any bombing.
There was a home guard, wasn't there?
We had a home...
People used to have to go up on the fells to...
We had a home guard, and we had a Royal Observer Corps.
Right.
I was a member of both. The Royal Observer Corps was situated in a wooden hut between Burnbanks and Bampton, on the left-hand side as you leave Burnbanks, in a wooden hut. The names just escaped me. And I also was a member of the Home Guard, and our place of residence was the village substation, where I used to do the charging of the batteries. Probably I should leave out the name of the corporal that was in charge, but there was three of us and the corporal. He was an ex-World War I serviceman. He would show us how to load and unload a 303 rifle. This is midnight to 1 o'clock in the morning. The place we're in is the village substation, a stone-built building, which, you know, concrete stone-built building. He puts the rounds of ammunition in the 303, and he was giving us a demonstration that he, ejecting the live bullets, and he said to us that whatever you do, always point the rifle away from you, you know, before you hand it back and press the trigger, just in case there was a round left in. And he did, and there was a round left in. We were all covered in dust. We were absolutely shattered. He was fortunate, he'd pointed the rifle away from where all the electrical cables were in the substation. But we never found the spent cartridge. But the man shall be nameless, because he did replace the bullets. There was only four instead of five at the bottom of the ammunition stock. That was rather... Could have been very dangerous. And it's an absolute true story. But the thing I remember most is all of us looking at each other, and we were covered in white dust. Quite an explosion.
Yes, yes.
It's true. In regarding the Home Guard and this Observer Corps, PC Ossel had a habit of coming round to the living premises of the club while I was in there. Well, I don't suppose he knew I was the only one in there, but he used to come round and knock at the door, then have me outside looking, kneeling. That there was a chink of light showing in the window that wasn't right, should be covered up.
Yes.
That was one of his duties. He didn't really care for us a lot, the Cannon family, because Colin hadn't been there too long when he got a knock at the door, and he introduced himself as the village constable. "Everything all right, Mr. Cannon?" And Colin said yes, everything was, and he hung about a lot, and anyway, he did eventually go, and Colin always said he thought he was after a drink, so he never gave him what. See, he wasn't allowed to enter those club premises unless he was required. Mm-hmm. So to get a drink, he had to go all the way to the Horsewater Hotel.
Really?
And see Harold Hazlehurst, or after Harold had gone into the Air Force, Mrs. Hazlehurst, who they had the tenancy of the Horsewater Hotel. Mrs. Hazlehurst was a daughter of the Bellises, who had the Crown and Mitre at Bampton Grange, which Colin and his daughter Margaret eventually took over in 67?
Yeah,
67, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Colin was the youngest landlord in the, so be it, in the country, when at the age of 21 he took over the unexpired portion of the tenancy for the Greyhound Hotel after Mr. Burns had died. Mr. Burns had been the proprietor up to his death, but there must have been a period of tenancy up to the expiry that Colin took charge of. And unfortunately, when the Mardale was submerged, unfortunately for Colin, Bob Daffin, who had the old Dunbull at Mardale, he got the tenancy of the Greyhound. And Bob Daffin wanted Colin to be his, like, well, under manager. Colin, you know, preferred having had it himself. And that's why he applied for the job at Burnbanks for this club. And he was most surprised when he was called to Manchester for the interview, and not being married, to get the job, because really, at that time, it was classed as a fairly good job, with house free, etc., living accommodation and all that free, and it certainly provided us with a good home. There was a lot of people would have liked to have had that position.
Did you help out in the
Oh, I did. I helped out sometimes when I shouldn't have done. And that's where I gained a lot of experience of the characters of people. People who probably, you know, try to make out, you know, they had a bit of money, but they used to be rattling the money around in the pockets. There was quite a, you know, quite a thing. And when the best end was, you were classed as a, you know, well it was for the bosses, really, the best end of the club.
Did you say that was a separate room?
That was a separate room, yes. Entirely.
Yes.
The separate room was if you, you know, you were a foreman, joiner, or the decorator, you know, you were in there, you didn't really want to mix with the navvies. Some people that were senior didn't mind. They're quite, you know. But others like to be aloof, away from the rest.
Was there that feeling in the rest of the village at all?
There might have been, I think. Maybe there might.
Because the wooden buildings at
Nadalgate, yeah.
That's where the...
Nadalgate it was, that's correct, wasn't it?
Yes.
Actually, I think there was about a dozen of them there. Mm. As I say, I remember the names of, you know, three or four of them that lived in there. Ossle lived, Petrie Ossle lived just at the one as you came into the village, right at the first one. And then the others were round the corner, going up to where you go to the hotel. There'd be about four or five down there, as I say, were in his retirement, sold them, and it was good enough for him to live there. He quite liked it. I know I had a job when I was in there, of seeing up in his loft all his gear. He had his Panama hats and putting it all away. He was quite a nice chap, quite a nice man. Yeah.
Was he the one that rode a penny farthing?
Oh, Mr. Jamieson, I think he rode a penny farthing. He lived at Wallam Gate. I think it was Wallam Gate. That was on the road down to Bampton, on the right hand side as you leave Burnbanks. He was a very, 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 very clever man, Mr. Jamieson. Very clever man. You saw little of him, but you soon got the okay when he left his office, to walk round the site. Everybody, Mr. Jamieson's on the by everybody made sure they were doing something. But I never, as I say, the only time I was called was, did I think I mentioned that, been taken to task after being, you know, going to, thinking I was going to go into the RAF, which now when I look back, I think it did me a good turn. I could easily have been shot down. Yeah.
Someone else has mentioned Someone else mentioned that they thought that there was a gate at the entrance to Burnbanks that at times was kept closed, and someone else said, "No, that's rubbish."
No, rubbish.
Wasn't a gate.
Rubbish. There was no gate.
Yeah.
No gate there at all. I won't mention, because it shouldn't be recorded, actually. When Colin, he wasn't the one to gate there. He'd been at the auction mart at Penrith, and there's Ossal, where he was jealous of him, of Colin, and he's waiting for him coming into the village. And he accused him of having 2 5-gallon drums of petrol in his car, and Colin hadn't got any, but they were in the beer cellar. So I shouldn't. This should.
It's a long time ago. I don't think it'll matter particularly.
Anyway, it did. So I came up. There was a search made of the cellar, the gardens with all the beautiful dahlias that he had, Colin, in the gardens, the rear of the building. Searching with his stick to see if there was any more. So it became a court case because it storing petrol without a licence, and it was in the war years.
It was rationed and everything.
So I said, "Oh, well, not to worry, Mr. Cannon, he would put in a good case for him when he appeared in court." So Colin appeared at Penrith Court. He was fined the sum of £10. Austell put up a terrific case for himself, not for Colin, saying that slight spillage of this petrol with a match, the whole place could have gone up in flames. And as I say, that was the end of the story, but it definitely spoiled Colin when he applied for a tenancy of another hotel, because he had this conviction,
yes,
of having petrol. And that petrol was only stored there because he'd been talked into having it by 2 of his so-called friends that were in the club. And I think he feels that they then, after he got it, went and told PC Austell that Colin had it. And there was a slight bit of jealousy crept in the village, really, I think. Because people used to think probably maybe they should have had the job or something, you know. I don't know.
People are like that sometimes, aren't they?
Yeah, it may have been.
Yes.
But I know you made a big case of this, that did. Yeah. Oh, but there was certainly no gate.
No.
Unless I can't see it, but there was no gate, certainly. Unless it was there
before
I went. Mm, okay. I don't think there was a gate.
No.
Okay. See, quite, you know, up to Mardale Church, you see, you know, the I didn't really know much about Mardale, really, but of course there was, you know, that's already been recorded, hasn't it?
That's...
Time and time again,
yes,
about,
yes,
all the bodies being removed from the church, right, and the last christening, and Crabtree was that one of the...
Raymond Crabtree.
There was a very large... Crabtree's a very, very large family. There must have been about 13 or so crab trees in the village. Yeah, very large family. I think Bob Crabtree was the father, I think. Hi, Bob, hi. Yeah, I remember, see, these people used to come too from Morecambe to give cinema shows as well. They came probably every month. Robinsons of Appleby, they were another firm, coaching firm, but they were mainly just for the one-off, for the, you know, the trips out, say, to Morecambe or Blackpool once a year. But the contract for the buses was definitely Coulson's of Penrith. They were the people. As I say, I know the last bus was 10:30 on a Saturday, but I don't think it was as late as that in the weekdays. I don't think so.
So walking back
was the thing.
Happened quite often.
Yeah.
I think we've probably. Do you think we've covered?
Yeah, they see. Yeah, see. I don't see Horace Horrocks. He was another I think he was Mr. Jameson's chauffeur initially. But as I say, in latter years, it was Arthur Robinson that was the chauffeur. I remember, and Madge was his sister that had the news agency and post office. That's right. She had the post office as Madge. Then she got married to Tim Scott. Well, Tim used to assist me when I was on my own doing any electrical repairs and that. Tim would work for me, like, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was...
Do you think we've reached an end?
I think we have.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
All right. I think we have.